Hi, I'm Jillian Swinford.
And I'm Haley Brolison.
And this is Mother Nature Will Kill You,
a podcast about the most horrific tragedies
and the most triumphant survival stories that the wilderness can provide.
So grab your backpack
and maybe a bottle of wine.
And let's go on a wild ride into the unknown.
Walking down this road I go, but I am going alone. Running far, far from home, till I am but skin and bone. I don't wanna die, but I'll have to try. Oh, I don't wanna die, but I'm on my own.
Good morning.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Good evening, wherever you are in the world.
Yep. Which it has truly been the summer of climate change.
Yeah.
I've been talking about, I talked about that with my dad and my mom yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
I don't particularly feel like Texas has been any much more hotter than it usually is. I guess maybe in Austin and like inland.
That was fucking hot.
Down here on the coast, it's like, no, this is pretty normal for us. This is just kind of how it is.
Yeah. Which but, is insane.
Yeah. You know, we have coral bleaching in your neck of the woods.
Yeah, which yeah. I think maybe it's kind of starting to get a little bit better because we have had some summer storms roll through, so it's cooled the water down a little bit. And we've seen signs of recovery in some corals, but yeah, for like a week and a half there, it was not good.
Not great. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So they were asking me, like, well, what are they just going to stop seeing animals? Like, how's that going to work? I'm like, well, it's still more gradual than you think it will be. And like the large scale migratory animals won't be as affected. But, you know, the species that depend on the reef entirely will be. So,
yeah.
That is what it is.
It's really sad watching like a whole ecosystem on the brink of extinction happen right before your eyes.
Yeah.
I mean, especially like when you work in the field, and that was something that I was talking with a coworker about the other day, is like, I don't think a lot of people, even some of the people that are higher up, I guess you could say, like in the business, are being mindful of the emotional toll that it's like that's occurring with the staff who are dealing with this like directly. They're exhausted every which way, physically, mentally, emotionally. It's definitely taking a toll on them, and it's sad. I mean, it scares me, but I'm in marketing. I'm not one of the people that deal with that like, firsthand, you know? I can't even imagine. Yeah, I can't even imagine. I mean, you think about it, like they've spent years of their life like dedicated to this one species or like one ecosystem. And then within a week, everything, if like almost all, not everything, but a lot, high percentage of mortality occurs. And it leaves you with the feeling of like, why am I even trying? Why am I even doing this? So
one of my first supervisors, when I like my first real like biology job, I worked for the Bull Run Mountain Conservancy, which is like 5 minutes away from our house. And so it was all terrestrial stuff. It's all like forests and stuff like that. And he was like, I wanted to go into marine biology. He knew that. And he was like, good luck, because that's one of the most depressing fields to work in.
Yeah. Things die all the time.
I was like, all right, well, I'm going to do it anyway, because I'm already sad. So then we also have freaking wildfires in Canada and in Maui. In Lahaina, which was a place that we visited. And I will talk more about that, because that is such a huge big scary thing that has happened, and the fallout from it is even worse because people are monsters.
Yeah, I'm sure. I heard that people are like trying to buy up the land there to develop. They're like, all right, like you can't use this anymore. I'll buy it from you and I'll build something on it. And then I guess like the locals are pretty much saying like, fuck off. Like, how could you now? You know,
it's fucking shitty.
Yeah.
But now we also have the first hurricane to hit California or LA, I guess, in.
Since 93.
No, it's 1930.
1930? Oh my God. I got the date. Yeah. Okay. I got the dates wrong on that. I thought it was 1993. My dyslexic hit, I guess.
Yes. That's exactly what happened.
But yeah, no, I saw that on the news the other morning, and like I texted our family chat because my brother is north of LA, just a little bit north, with his family. And I was like, hey, dude, like you guys got to get your shit together this weekend because Sunday night, Monday morning, like it's going to hit, it's going to suck. But then I was like zooming in and out on like Windfinder and like the Weather Channel radar, like all that stuff. And they are just outside of the cone. Like the cone is pretty narrow. Yeah. So, I mean, at least that's good. But I did tell them, I was like, you know, you're right outside the cone. Like it could shift at any time. I was like, we saw that with Ian, like it was supposed to go around us. And then like literally the night before it's going over the Dry Tortugas. So like we got, you know, impacted from it, like from the outer bands. But we were also like on the right side of that storm, and like being on the right side is the bad side. And my brother and his family is on the left side of the storm. So I'm like, I think like whatever happens, like they'll probably be okay. But it's like just another shock into like, wow, okay, California is getting their first hurricane since the 30s. Like that's insane. And
yeah, so you're saying your brother is outside of it. My brother is inside of it.
Oh my God.
Because he's at Fort Irwin right now.
Even
which he can't do anything about. It's the army. That's where he has to be.
I know. Oh my God.
They're doing training, and at first I was like, well, Fort Irwin's a desert, but then my mom was
it's going right over. Yeah.
Yes. And the flooding, like the flash flooding.
Yes. Yes. That's what I told my brother. I was like, if you guys get flooded, like it's gonna be for sure flooding. And then, like, if power goes out, like, you guys need to make sure you have, like, stocks of food. Like, they just had fucking twins. They have, like, you know, like, 1-month-old twins. I was like, you guys need to make sure you have your shit together.
You need supplies.
Also have and he also has a 3-year-old. And then my mom was like, make sure you fill your big bathtub up with water so, like, you can use it to flush the toilets, like, if you need to. And my brother goes, oh, I was just going to leave Hike's kiddie pool outside and just use that if we need to, like, fill anything with water.
The fuck away.
So then that's when I started sending screenshots of, like, what category hurricanes mean based off of wind speed.
Yeah.
I was like, dude, this is already a category 4 hurricane. So it has, like, max 156 winds right now. Like, it's 130 to 156 winds right now. When it hits, it's probably going to be, like, a category 2. But, like, it'll be tropical storm force winds when you guys get surrounded. So like that's gonna
lift
blow
a kiddie pool up into
the air. It's like, dude, what? Like, and honestly, I was like, take it from your sister who literally lives in Hurricane Central. Like, trust me on this one. You don't want to fuck around with it. Like,
I mean, thankfully my brother's not so far removed from living in Virginia that he forgets what a hurricane is. But at the same
my brother
time,
just doesn't think.
It's like they literally. Like, Ethan is very smart, and I'm not so worried about the supply situation because they're, like, in training, so they have supplies, they're in, like, a survival-esque situation already, but, like, if a flash flood comes down whatever gully, it'll just fucking take those buildings with it.
Yeah.
So, we're concerned.
Yeah, I would be concerned, too.
Yeah.
I'm going to be thinking about him until that storm passes, and I will be texting you asking for updates.
The problem is he can't really give us updates.
Oh, yeah, because it's like they take his phone or whatever. Not take it, but he has to put it away kind of thing. Yeah.
So that's fun. And it's like, it's only a category 1. And yes, it might hit as a 2, but then it'll slow down. The thing is, though, this area
it's not built for it.
It's not.
Yeah.
They're not used to it. It's going to be chaos.
That's what I was trying to get through to my brother. I was like, you guys haven't had a hurricane hit since, well, I said 90s, but it's really the 30s. But I was like, you guys haven't had a hurricane hit in so long. Like, you aren't prepared for this. Like, California is prepared for earthquakes and things like that, but they're not prepared for, like, flooding.
They're going to have, like, wind damage.
Yeah.
People are going to be buried under their houses.
Like, yes. Yeah, I'm concerned, but they're outside of the cone. If they're in the cone, I'd be even more concerned. But yeah. I told them, I was like, you know, you guys are probably going to be okay. Because even on Windfinder, the winds didn't seem to hit them so bad there. Maybe because, like, they're higher in elevation or something. But, like, mm-hmm. and I don't know if elevation has anything to do with wind speed. Probably does, but I don't know. But, but it, I was telling them, like, with Ian, I was like, it could still shift a little bit, you know, because mm-hmm. it hits the coast like pretty much around San Diego, and it's like if it just tracked off a little bit more and went up the coast a little bit more towards LA, I was like, you guys would be fucked. Like, that's not
It'd
okay.
It'd be nice for my brother. He'd be
I know, it would be nice for your brother.
Okay.
And it goes, and then like it dissipates. I was watching it. It dissipates over Las Vegas.
Yeah, like, that's so wild.
I know. I was like, what the hell, Las Vegas? Like, that's just so beyond my brain, because I always think hurricanes like down here, like Florida, Georgia, Louisiana, like the Carolinas, Texas. Yeah, I'm like, oh, like Las Vegas, inland? Like,
yeah, and that's the thing. These events are going to start happening more frequently. This is what the climate change is. It's not just the temperature. It's the weather patterns. Everything is changing. Everything is shifting. Tornado Alley is shifting further east. We're getting more hurricane events in general.
Mm-hmm.
And now we're getting hurricane events in places that don't have hurricanes. And we have wildfires in fucking Hawaii.
Yeah.
Like, it's, what?
It's insane.
What is happening?
I was just going to, I'm looking at the wind finder right now. Okay. And I was just going to say, we have about 4 storms around us right now.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that was also like in my text messages to my brother. I was like, dude, we have 4 storms coming for us. Like, trust me. Like,
yeah.
I was like, it's like back to back to back. Thankfully, it looks like they're all kind of going to go out into the Atlantic and dissipate, and it won't ever really be a problem.
Dude, we could use a damn tropical storm. We need some rain out here.
Well, we do. Yeah, that's the thing. Like, that's what we're saying too with the reef. We're like, we could use a good storm, but we're like, we don't want a category storm. We just give us like a tropical storm. Yeah. Like, cool it down.
Oh, yeah. I'll take a tropical storm right now. Yeah. And that's the difference between the Gulf and California. You know what I mean?
It's like, we're like wishing for a tropical storm right now. Like,
because we're prepared for it.
Yeah, but like Sunday, there's like, you can see how there's like two, just like, but they're going up and out, but.
Bastards.
I know.
Well, so anyway, speaking of the fires in Maui, so Corey and I went to Maui on our honeymoon in 2021. Lahaina was one of the places we went to. That's where we did like all of our diving. It's this like old town on the western side of the island. It's like the kind of like a Hawaiian cultural center of sorts. It was the colonial seat of power. But it was also like the Hawaiian seat of power when they were their own kingdom before they got the kingdom basically gotten stolen by the United States, because that's fucking what happened.
Yeah.
And so when we were there, we really tried to go to like native Hawaiian owned places, restaurants, tours as much as we could. Because so much of this island has been taken over by corporations, by big hotels, by fucking white people, like wanting to claim a bit of paradise for themselves. But in doing that, they drive the prices up so, so much that Native Hawaiians can't afford to live there anymore.
Gotcha. That stinks. Really, yeah. It is. And it's like, it's the whole tourism industry, right? It's like, it's happening down here. It's like these millionaires are buying homes here. And then it's like the workforce has no place to live.
Right. Right.
And then it's like, who do you think is running paradise down here for you? Like, who's going to do it when you, like, what restaurant's going to be open when you want to come down on your vacation if no one can live here and work at that restaurant? Like,
but it's even worse because it's like, it's literally their ancestral home. Yes.
Yeah. No, I understand. Like, it's
forcefully taken from. I'm it's kind of like that everywhere, but it's like it's so much worse in Hawaii because of that aspect of it.
Yeah. Know? Oh, for sure.
So we'll talk about the fires first. So this started on August 8th, and more than 100 lives were lost during this.
Yeah.
When I no
first
joke.
When I first saw it, it was like, I think 30 deaths were the thing. And then like the next day it was like 60. And I was like, oh dear God, this is just awful.
It's awful. So perfect storm conditions led to deadly blazes. The drought blanketing swath of the archipelago played a major role. So there were a lot of areas facing moderate and severe drought on specifically Maui. And then there was a hurricane, Hurricane Dora, mm-hmm. in the Pacific that was 100 miles south of Hawaii. So it didn't hit Hawaii. But
you get the effects of it, though, right?
There like were the winds yeah. that basically helped spread this fucking fire.
Mm-hmm.
So this was described by the governor as the largest natural disaster in Hawaii state history. There's several fires going on in Maui. They're not just the Lahaina one, but the Lahaina one has had the most destruction. There's also been fires on all of the islands as well. So it's not just Maui, but this is just like, because of the death toll, you know, this one is the worst. So Tuesday, August 8th, 12 a.m., a bushfire started in Maui's upcountry region, later growing to 1,000 acres. At least 50 people had to take cover in an emergency shelter. As this fire is raging, a smaller bushfire fueled by strong winds from Hurricane Dora prompts evacuations near Lahaina School. Fire officials declare it 100% contained just before 9 a.m. The National Weather Service in Honolulu issues red flag and high wind warnings at 9:26 a.m. This is when the fire that was not put out properly, I guess, spread. So a Lahaina fire flare-up prompts evacuations, a road closure, and a shelter-in-place advisory on western Maui. So I'll kind of describe to you what this area kind of looks like. It is on the drier side of the island. The wet side of the island is like Hana, and it's very jungly, and there weren't fires over there. It's
okay.
So from
it's
what
like
I
really
can
the
tell.
Towns that are burning?
Yeah, so in Lahaina, there's a very, there's the mountains basically on your eastern side, very steep. There's not, it's the entire town is like basically on the coastline. There's really only one road in and one road out.
God, that's scary.
And it's like a two-lane road.
Yeah, that's exactly like right here. It's like if there's a hurricane to hit or a fire to hit,
yeah,
one way in, one way out.
Because I mean, we rented a car, we drove all over the island, so we've been down that road where people were like, it was very familiar watching people because we got stuck in traffic there for, you know, an accident or something.
Yeah,
coming in,
I heard that people were jumping into the water because they were like, they were ditching their cars and they're like, I don't know what to do, but I'm gonna go in the water.
Yeah. So at 3:43 p.m. Lieutenant Governor Sylvia Luque, Hawaii's acting governor, issues an emergency proclamation to activate assistance from the state's National Guard. And this is when the fire starts hitting the town as well. So at 4:45 p.m., evacuations continue for several Lahaina neighborhoods after an earlier flare-up closes the Lahaina bypass. That's, I believe, there's two roads in the actual town that you can go through. So there's a bypass, and then there's one that goes straight through the town.
Mm-hmm.
So you can avoid going into the town if you are going
really
further.
Really want to, yeah.
5:50 p.m., Air Force veteran Bosco J.R. Bay, who's new to Hawaii, tried to save his Lahaina apartment building Tuesday from the raging flames. He grabbed a water hose to stop the spread. Everything was on fire. At one point, I had to stay on the ground and wait for the thick smoke to clear. The blowing embers in the wind looked like it was raining fire, said Bay, who fought the fire with a friend for a couple of hours before it became too much to handle. They evacuated around 8 p.m. local time. So there, oh my gosh, this is a really thorough. So this is a CNN timeline. There's a video of a Lahaina resident sheltering on the rocks by the sea, and there's literally just everything around them is ablaze.
Ugh. That's
so
scary.
People were literally, jumping into the ocean
yeah,
to escape it. So 9:45 p.m., the Coast Guard begins rescuing people entering the Pacific Ocean to flee the fiery smoking conditions. They help at least 14 people, including two children. And this is in high wind conditions, so the surf is rough.
Yeah. Oh, my God.
Right?
So, remind me again how these fires happened. It was because, like, the winds from the storm kind of was the quote-unquote fuel, but there had to have been a spark. Was it just dry cigarette butt? Like,
I don't know if they know what caused it initially.
Oh, gosh.
So the island is already in high drought conditions. So
okay. Could have just been dry. And
so they don't, from what I can tell, they don't know what caused it yet specifically. Yeah. But so
yeah, that's sad.
Here's some more quotes. Breathing through a wet shirt didn't help stop heavy smoke from seeping into the lungs of Stephen Potter as he ran from his car and for his life near Lahaina's Front Street on Wednesday. Front Street is like the main tourist avenue.
Mm-hmm.
I was coughing up black, Potter told CNN. People fled toward the water. He said, we ended up waiting down on the rocks for 8 hours until firefighters came to rescue us. At 11:52 p.m., the Hawaiian National Guard deploys on Maui as wildfires burn out of control. So Wednesday, August 9th, 1:20 a.m., fires leave more than 14,000 customers without power on Maui as the winds associated with Dora continue to fan the flames. 2:45 a.m., drone footage shows the fires moving. Oh, sorry, that's not important. 5:03 a.m., fire strip one of the largest banyan trees in the U.S. imported to Maui in 1875 from India of much of its vegetation. More than 60-foot tall tree stretches an entire city block. And I've seen it. We went because I specifically wanted to see this tree. So I have pictures with the tree.
Like, yeah.
Corey. So, like, we literally spent a week here, which a lot of people have. I'm not saying I'm special, but it just, it's so crazy to see this destruction.
I'm sure.
After being here just a very short time ago. I really hope that tree survives. It's a big tree, so it might. But 9:25 a.m., over 2,100 people seek refuge overnight in four Maui shelters. 9 p.m., military helicopters douse Maui County with about 150,000 gallons of water to fight the fires. Thursday, August 10th, 10 a.m., the California Office of Emergency Services announces plan to send a search and rescue team to Maui to help search for survivors and aid with recovery efforts. This is 2 days after 10:30 a.m. Officials report the fire in Lahaina is 80% contained. The town remains without power.
Oh my God. So that's the hardest part too, is like without power. Like, where do they go?
Yeah.
And like, they can't get evacuated because I'm sure the infrastructure is fucked for planes to land there.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, what's happening? Who's helping them?
The National Guard and whoever else, but.
Oh my God.
The Lahaina fire left the historic Maui Whaling Village appearing as though a bomb had gone off. Iconic buildings were left flattened or scorched by roaring flames. CNN's chief climate correspondent Bill Weir reported from the damaged Lahaina town Thursday. There was just lifeless, smoky, and sooty devastation where Lahaina town used to be. And it is, I'm looking at a map, it's a majority of the town.
Yeah.
That got absolutely decimated. It's devastating because I've fucking been here, so I know what it looks like. And so now developers are trying to come in and buy up people's houses, majority mm-hmm. Native Hawaiians, or at least people who were born in Hawaii and have lived there, and they're just normal people. They're trying to buy up their burnt down properties.
Yeah.
At a fraction of what they would cost if there was a building still on it. But because there's not a building on it, they can pay them cheaper.
Mm-hmm. It's so fucked.
And apparently, people who have their houses still are getting eviction notices.
Really?
Yeah.
Why?
Because they're trying to buy up as much as they can so they can build stuff on it.
Oh my goodness.
So it is awful, and it's going to disproportionately affect Native Hawaiians and average Hawaiian people.
Yeah, that's awful.
It is disgusting. These people are so predatory. And it's it almost makes me wonder.
Like kicking someone when they're down, you know what I mean?
Yeah. And like it's not just like condos and hotels. Like this town had actual, honest to God, neighborhoods, which is unusual.
Mm-hmm.
Like had neighborhoods. It wasn't all just for tourism. Like people lived there, you know. And then there were these important cultural buildings. I mean, this is probably one of the oldest towns, like, in the area.
Yeah.
Now, is it heavily tinged with aspects of colonialism? Yes. There's also, like, very important cultural areas, too. Like, there's old school Native Hawaiian, like ruins and stones and stuff that mm-hmm. are left over. Now, granted, those didn't get burned, but it's not like it's just a tourist town, is my point.
Yeah, you know what I mean? There's very much a like a cultural, historic,
yes,
like I don't know, not I want to say the word vibe, but I know vibe is not the right word.
Is that a cultural and historic vibe to it? Yeah.
That's what I'm like, I cannot say that. I know I can't, but my brain isn't working. So, but I get what you're saying. It's not just like they built this place for tourism. Like there is a history here of people's culture and it's important to them.
Yes.
And like, I mean, talk about getting haunted, right? Like they, you know, like all the spiritual things that they believe in too. And then like, things like this happen and then a developer wants to come in and take their land, like that developer is getting fucking haunted for the rest of their life.
I hope so. Yeah, no, that it's horrible, and I just hope that people see how disgusting this level of capitalism and just sheer like we're gonna benefit from these people suffering.
Yeah, like no, there's gotta bad.
Be a point where we stop doing this shit.
Well, it's like, do you not even, like, have any, I don't know, like mindfulness is really what I'm getting at. You know, it's like, be mindful. Like, somebody just literally lost their home, probably lost all of their family.
Yeah.
And now you're like, hey, I'll come in and buy this from you. Here's some money to make you feel better. It's like, money doesn't make anybody feel better in that situation.
Oh, because this is already something that's been happening in the Hawaiian Islands for so long. You know, people coming in, buying up land, making private beaches for their hotels. So natives, Hawaiians can't access the ocean in a lot of places anymore. And Lahaina was one of the places where you could. I mean, that's one of the reasons why we went, because it's like, well, we don't have to stay at one of these fucking fancy hotels.
Yeah, we can just like, go to the beach.
Go to the beach. And that was a big draw, because all we wanted to do was go snorkel.
Like,
And so, anyway, so I'm very passionate, if you can't tell, about this, because it's so maddening. So if you actually want to help in a meaningful way and not in a way that's going to support like corporations mm-hmm. and hotels and things like that, I have a couple suggestions from one of my favorite local artisans in Maui, Kalua. Mm-hmm. They do these really, really pretty fabric prints that are all like Hawaiian like foliage and
how do you spell
creatures.
That?
It's Kulua. And we went to their brick and mortar store in Makawao, which is in the upcountry. And they have a lot of really good suggestions that I'm going to suggest here. So they are donating 10% of their sales to the Maui Strong Fund already. So if you want to buy something from them, that you would be contributing for the rest of the month, and it might extend, we'll see. If you're looking for ways to donate directly, you can donate to Maui United Way, Hawaii Community Foundation, Hawaiian Council, Maui Rapid Response, or the Maui Food Bank. And these are ways to donate so that the money will go more directly to people mm-hmm. who are suffering, who have lost their homes, and not to developers.
That's good.
I will put that on the, I don't know, description, podcast description as well. But I'm probably going to donate, because this is something that is really affecting me right now.
Yeah, no, I mean, once you're there, like it really does affect you in that way.
Yeah, and it just I feel like I put so much effort into trying to do tourism the right way when I was there. I just hate to see this happen.
Oh my God, I know.
Because it's such a beautiful place, the beautiful people, like every Native Hawaiian person we interacted with was just so loving, so open, like, and once we told them, like what we were doing, like we, really wanted to like shop local, go to local businesses. We even stayed with like a local Hawaiian woman when we were in Hana. So, and it's hard to do, I'll tell you that much. It's hard to do, unfortunately. And so it's just something that's really important to me. And so if you want to support, there you go.
That's how you do it. I mean, I'm
Get
just
off
a big
my.
fan of, like, I don't know, like traveling sustainably, I guess you could say too.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, you see it down here, like, and we've joked about it from time to time. Like, we've heard people on the street like talking about like where they want to go eat, and then they're like, oh, fuck it, let's just go to Sonic or whatever. Like,
Yeah.
and it's like, dude, you're surrounded by so much good Cuban food here. Like, and you're just gonna
Right.
go to Sonic? Like,
Oh my God, there's
what?
so much good Cuban food.
I know. I was like, go get yourself a Cuban sandwich. Like, that shit is the bomb. That heals
Yeah.
any ails for me. I'm like, all I want is just a Cuban sandwich and, like, I don't know, like a water. Like, that's like
Yeah.
all I
Dude,
need.
when we're going down for the wedding, we're gonna go to El Saboni because that place
Yes.
is the bomb.
So good.
So
I know,
good.
it's so good. There's a spot called Rita's right across from the Green Parrot. And back before I would go down to Key West all the time, we would go down to the Green Parrot with some friends, like, and go down to the Green Parrot for like ukulele night, or just like go down to like pregame there before like a concert or something.
Yeah.
But there's a restaurant called Rita's, and it's like this very small hole in the wall Cuban
Yes, hole in the
restaurant
walls.
that's like right across from the Green Parrot. And it's
Yeah.
like you just go up to the window, get yourself a Cuban sandwich, and then you get it to go, walk back over to the Green Parrot, just sit outside with a beer, and like, because you can't bring food in, but they have like the outside seating that it's like open air bar kind of thing.
Yeah.
And then you get yourself a beer, have yourself a Cuban sandwich, and then walk over to the amphitheater. And then
Right?
it was so great. I was like, this is awesome. Like, I love this stuff. But yeah, I've seen it before down here too, where it's like there's so much good Cuban food, but then you overhear conversations of people just going to like a general chain restaurant.
So
And you're like,
weird.
come on, dude. Like, just pick something local, or even like shopping local. Like, I mean, there's a bunch of artists down here who, like, that's how they
Yeah.
make their living. So.
Yep. Yes, it's sustainable traveling is
Yeah, I'm a big
yes.
fan of that.
And we did it as in Finland. I mean, we had local guides, so it was easy. But
Yeah.
in the States, I try to do it to like go to local owned places, and it takes some research. So, do you want to get into our story?
Sure, yeah.
So, I went on kind of a deepish dive for this one, deeper than I thought,
Yeah.
because
Love when that
I ended up
happens.
making it two parts.
Oh.
So this is part one that we're going to be talking about today,
Cool.
and this is kind of a culmination of things. So there's kind of two stories that we're going to be talking about, but one we'll be talking about a bit more.
Yeah.
So, have you ever seen the movie The Perfect Storm?
I don't think I have, but I've heard of it. So when I saw the title of this, I was like, oh shit, I've
Yeah.
heard of this. But I never
So
knew what it was about.
it's this kind of. So
Okay.
it's got George Clooney in it, it's got Marky Mark. It's got John C.
Nice.
Reilly.
Okay.
So there's some big stars, but it I think was 2000 when this movie came out. So it's an
Yeah.
older one, but you can watch it on Hulu, which I did with Corey.
Yeah.
And we'll get into, obviously what the movie was about. And this is kind of, how we like to talk about hurricanes.
Yeah.
I like to talk about
Well, I
hurricanes
mean,
like around this time of year because it's on the mind, and
yeah, hurricane season literally lasts half of a year for us down here.
it does,
Like,
yeah.
most half of your year is spent in anxious, like, spirals. So it's
Yeah.
fine.
I would say for us it's like July to November probably.
Yeah.
We haven't had one yet, so it'd be nice if we had a tropical fucking storm though.
Yeah.
So this takes place off the coast of Canada, which is not necessarily known for hurricanes.
But they go up there, though.
They do. Yeah, they absolutely I see them. And so this is kind of in the same vein as like climate change, because it's kind of a historic event weather-wise. And it involves a low category hurricane turning everything up to 10. And
because that happens.
This hurricane didn't even make landfall.
Yeah, it just hung out there.
Yeah. And so this is what happens when you underestimate a hurricane.
Basically. Ricky, if you're listening to this, fucking kiddie pools outside. Are you kidding me?
Bathtubs. Fill up your damn bathtubs. If you're in California, anywhere near this thing, fill up your fucking bathtub.
Put it this way. If he was giving me earthquake advice, I would take it.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. So let's get into what exactly happened. So late in October of 1991, the Swordfish Fleet, meaning all of the swordfish boats from the U.S. and Canada, were out running a late season trip on the Grand Banks off the coast of Nova Scotia, which is Canada for anybody who doesn't know. Seas had been calm and fishing had been decent until a weather fax came in on October 28th. The fax reads, Hurricane Grace moving, will turn northeast and accelerate. Developing dangerous storm moving east 35 knots, will turn southeast and slow by 12 hours. Forecast winds 50 to 65 knots and seas will be 22 to 32 feet within 400 nautical miles semicircle. That means nothing if you don't know shit about storms.
I was like, I don't know what that means. I know what like the winds mean and the seas, but the semicircle.
But this means the Sword Fleet knows that they may be in for a rough one.
Yeah.
And let's talk about why. Let's talk about how the storm created itself.
Oh, so, no.
Hurricane Grace was a late season fluke hurricane and was originally supposed to hit the Carolinas, but a cold front pushed her offshore and northward. Hurricanes form when low pressure areas coming from the Sahara move over moisture-rich warm water. Warm air rises as they move, causing a low pressure system, which causes more air to rush in. The air rises and cools as thunderstorms. When water condenses, it forms droplets, and it releases, like, that condensation actually releases even more latent heat energy until the air and condensed water form this fucking giant vortex. In addition to Grace, another storm was developing.
Oh, my God.
Over the Great Lakes region, which, as we know from our episodes talking about the Great Lakes, it can be pretty gnarly up there.
Yeah, that's insane.
So satellite images see a slight bend in a cold front developing over western Indiana on October 26th, which is a pocket of low pressure and what they call an embryo of a storm. So they're seeing this bend in the front and being like, there's a storm that's gonna fucking form there,
basically. Yeah. I guess it's like when you can tell, like, when the wind starts spiraling out on Windfinder, you're like, oh, something's developing right there.
Yeah. This low pressure follows the Canadian border to Montreal, cuts into Maine, crosses the Bay of Fundy and Nova Scotia. And by dawn on the 29th, the storm has turned into an all-out gale north of Sable Island, Canada. And Sable Island is like this sandbar that's just fucking out there in the ocean. I had to go look it up. They have wild ponies though, like shanty.
Oh, cool. Nice.
That's cool. I'm like, no, I want to go there. So warm air is rising to the top of the system faster than it can be replaced. So wind speed fucking increases. The barometric pressure is dropping more than a millibar an hour with 65 knot winds and 35 foot seas off of Sable Island. Now, on the 29th, the remnants of Hurricane Grace combine with this nor'easter. So, we have a megastorm.
Mm-hmm.
Grace was only a Category 2 hurricane and tracked out to the Atlantic and never actually made landfall in the U.S., but gave enough energy to the nor'easter that the perfect storm was created.
Oh.
This combination ultimately created a small, unnamed hurricane, which wreaked havoc in this region. It was unnamed so as not to cause confusion with the other hurricanes in the area. But it has now been called both the perfect storm and the Halloween nor'easter or Halloween gale.
Okay.
So that's, it has multiple names. They all reference this storm.
Yeah.
So if you scroll down, you can kind of see what the fuck happened. It's chaotic.
Oh my God. It looks like an infinity symbol.
Yes. That's basically, yeah. So at its peak, it attained winds of up to 70 miles per hour on October 31st at approximately noon. And it was situated about 390 miles south of Halifax, Nova Scotia. Wave heights on a buoy located 264 miles south of Halifax reported a max wave height of 100.7 feet.
Oh my God.
Yes. Which
what's
is the
biggest surf, like, now that makes me wonder, like, you know, big surf competitions, what's like the height of those waves?
We did a whole episode about that.
I know, but I don't remember things.
Well, the whole thing was like, we want to hit the 100-foot wave. So that's like the highest max that you could really hit.
Okay.
But this is happening in the middle of the ocean, not on the coast where it's breaking, which has, you have to have so much power in order to do that.
Yeah.
So 100.7 was the highest recorded wave on the Scotian shelf, like in recorded history.
Wow. So, yeah, I bet. Probably by like 30 feet too.
Yeah. Off Cape Cod, a buoy reported maximum sustained winds of 56 miles per hour with gusts of 75 miles per hour and wave heights of 39 feet, just significantly lower than that 100 foot. But imagine you're a boat and every wave around you is fucking 40 feet tall.
Yeah, that's scary.
That's big seas.
I think the max seas I've been in is like 10 foot waves and that freaked me out.
Right.
I can't imagine 40 foot.
So by November 1st, the nor'easter turned southward and slowly weakened until it met the warm waters of the Gulf Stream and then turned back into a tropical cyclone, turning northward as a Category 1 until it quickly weakened back to a tropical storm where it made landfall on Halifax, fully dissipating November 2nd. So this is a hot mess of a storm.
It is, and I was looking at that graph again. Not graph, but, like, the photo where it, like, swoops around itself.
Yeah.
And it's, like, when it crosses back over itself, it turns into a hurricane. So I'm curious if, like, in that center, if there was still some, like, I don't know, energy created from the storm, and it just picked back up right there, and then it took off again.
Possibly. Yeah, my other thought is it just took, there was a lag in the strength building from when it hits the Gulf Stream.
I mean, it seems like that's definitely more the possibility than there's still being energy there, because that was 2 days later where it made into a hurricane. But I don't know how, I mean, I don't know how big the bands are. Do you have a photo of like how big the bands are of the storm? Because if like it's circling around itself and it's like circles back in on the bands, I feel like that might still be a thing.
Here's putting a photo in for you now, dropping it in.
Okay, cool. Oh, wow. So
it's possible. Could have been latent energy.
Yeah.
I mean, it was literally just, like, sitting on top of this area for days.
Yeah.
That's basically what it was doing.
Just hanging out, gaining strength.
Yeah.
No biggie.
The hurricane for you.
Yeah. oh, my goodness.
So, this meteorological circumstance only occurs once every 50 to 100 years, this like combination of storms. So that's why it was named the perfect storm, because meteorologists were like, this is insane, and everyone else was like, oh my God, what is happening?
That's fair. Now I'm gonna go on like Noah's Hurricane Center and just check up on ourselves right now.
I'd love a tropical storm.
I really would. Oh, there's a name. There's a named one out there. Emily. They've named that one that's out there.
Let's go look.
There's one.
This is like a pastime for me now.
No, it is. Me too. Like this season, I'm like, oh, let's go look at the radar.
Which is crazy.
There's a disturbance number 3, 30% chance of cyclone formation in 48 hours right on top of us right now, essentially. So yeah, right now the activity and the Atlantic, for anybody listening, we have 5 storms out there right now.
Yay.
5. 2. 1 is named, another is a depression, and then the other 2 are disturbances.
Yes. Okay.
And that's what hurricane season is like for us down on the coast.
And then you sit there and then you wonder, okay, which one's going to hit me? And
yeah.
And which ones do I have to be concerned about? And do I have
how
to
much
evacuate?
Time do I have?
Or Joe, can I just stay? Because I'll tell you what, I understand why people don't evacuate for shit now, because like it's such a pain in the ass to keep doing that. Like if you have a lot of storms coming in, like every weekend, I'm like, no.
I would evacuate if it was like a category 4 or higher hitting us.
I would hope you would evacuate if it was a cat 3 hitting you directly.
Directly, yeah, I would definitely think about it. But I mean, Alex has to stay here. Like when Irma hit, they just caravan them up to Miami. But like the second it passed, they came back down because he's like a first responder. So
yeah,
he has to be here. And like the hardest part after a storm is the loss of power. Like, that's the thing that really gets people. It's like, you know, your house could be fine, but it's just that you don't have power to like turn your stove on, run your refrigerator, all that stuff. So,
So take it from 2 girls on the Gulf, you Californians, please.
Yeah.
Get some fucking supplies at the very least.
I know. We went and got like a lot of dry food yesterday, like a lot of like, I don't know, like tuna cans, tuna packets, and like mac and cheese, like boil and a cup things, like ramen, like a lot of stuff like that, just so we had some food around if it, we needed to. But
yeah, we should.
And then once
that.
Hurricane season's over, then you just eat it and then you stock back up next year.
I donate a lot of it actually if we don't eat it. Like,
yeah, that's a good
during
idea.
Thanksgiving,
too.
Yeah. Because that's about the end of the season. So I'm like,
yeah.
Or Christmas or whatever.
Meal drives and stuff. Yeah, that's a good idea, too.
So, all right. We just went on another hurricane.
Yeah,
tangent.
Sorry. My bad.
That's okay.
My brain wandered and I was like, let's see what's going on in the Atlantic right now.
So, the movie The Perfect Storm centers on the Swordfish fleet, specifically the Swordfish boat, the Andrea Gale, which was captained by Gloucester, Massachusetts raised, but Florida resident Billy Tyne, and owned by Bob Brown. The boat sailed out of Gloucester and was crewed by Michael Bugsy Moran, Dale Murph Murphy, who's played by John C. Reilly in the movie.
Okay.
Alfred Pierre, Bobby Shatford, who was played by Marky Mark.
Nice.
David Sullivan. The boat left Gloucester Harbor on September 20th before any of the other sword boats did. So they were out early. And Billy Tyne, the captain, is played by none other than George Clooney. So, you know, all-star cast.
Yes.
Most of the boats in the fleet were bound for the Grand Banks to get one more fishing trip out, like, before the season closed out. The Grand Banks are a series of underwater plateaus east of Newfoundland, which support some of the world's richest fishing grounds and are fed by both the nutrient-rich Labrador Current from the north and the warm Gulf Stream from the south. So it's like the perfect breeding ground for plankton and zooplankton.
Yeah.
And then therefore everything comes and meets and you have a whole ecosystem happening
here.
While most of the banks are within Canada's EEZ, their like economic zone, the tail and the Flemish Cap, which is the eastern extremity, are not and are very lucrative for fishing. So American boats can fish out there as well because it's not in the EEZ. Fishing politics and is very interesting when you have 2 countries
in, yes,
or more than 2 countries involved. I took
it
a whole
really
class
is.
On it. So
yeah. No, that stuff blows my mind. And I honestly don't care enough about to like get into the politics of that.
Yeah.
So when I hear about it, I'm like, dude, let's just not go there.
So fishermen from Cape Cod used to heavily fish the George's Banks, which are a smaller series of plateaus off the coast of Cape Cod. But the area has since been partially turned into a marine protected area following the collapse of the cod fishery in the 1980s, and they don't support as much fish as the Grand Banks do.
Oh, wow.
But the Grand Banks are much further offshore.
Yeah.
So the Grand Banks, while rich, are also dangerous as they sit on one of the world's worst storm tracks in the world, because they get storms from both the Great Lakes regions and from Cape Hatteras, and occasionally a hurricane.
Gotcha.
So, yeah, they can be dangerous. So let's talk about swordfish.
Yeah, let's do it.
I am a marine biologist, and this is what I do. So swordfish, Xiphias gladius, on the Grand Banks are caught exclusively by long lining.
Yes.
They are large fast predatory fish that can swim up to 36 miles per hour and reach 10 feet in length.
They're large.
They're huge. And they use their bony sword that's on the tip of their little nose.
Mm-hmm.
Which, by the way, yeah, their rostrum. Thank you. Which can be like 4 to 5 feet on its own. So it can be like half of their body size.
Yeah.
And they use it, they think, to swipe and slash at prey and like stun and slice up their prey before they go after it.
Yeah.
Swordfish have been known to injure and even kill humans.
Oh, I'm sure. They probably impale them.
Yes, that's exactly what happened. And they have been known to drive their swords into the hulls of boats. So
also fair.
They will fuck you up. Yeah.
Yeah.
So they are known as the most dangerous game fish in the world for these regions. So if you're trying to like hook and line one of these puppies, it can be risky.
I believe it. I saw a video one time, I think it was like on YouTube or something, of somebody trying to catch a swordfish or a marlin, and like it jumped and like the bill went right down their throat. They're fine, but like it was like one of those like crazy scenarios. I'll try to find it when the Zoom ends, and I'll try to find it and send it to you. But yeah, wild.
All right, I gotta look up a pronunciation real quick. So Janjian. Are we sure about that?
I'm going to be sending this website to my brother in case he wants to keep track of this storm that's hitting him right now. Because they have a really nice graph on NOAA Hurricane Center's for the flash flooding risk over the next 3 days. And they are on the border of the moderate and high zone.
Good.
Sick, bro.
Rad. Okay. So let's talk about long lining a little bit, which is something I have actually done.
Me too.
For science. You too?
Yeah.
Okay. So
we're doing it for sharks.
Yeah, we did too. Did you do the NOAA thing?
I didn't do a NOAA thing. I did some other like nonprofit internship that was long lining for sharks.
Okay. Cause I got to go out with the like NOAA shark and red snapper long lining that they do. Basically, I think they do it all the way from like the Carolinas down through Texas. Oh,
that's awesome.
So I got to go on one of the Texas trips because they allow like one TPWD person to go.
Oh, cool.
For each like Texas based long lining trip. There's two of them.
Yeah.
So I got to long line for sharks and tag sharks, which was really, really cool. But so I've done this. And it seems like it's a little bit different with the way the Andrea Gale is set up from like what we did. Like, I feel like we had a lot of safety stuff that maybe the Andrea Gale didn't. And it's just like, we're doing it as quick as possible. But anyway, so long lining is a series of baited hooks and lines called gangians that are attached to one much longer line, which is marked by buoys and flyers, which have a light and I believe maybe a GPS marker on either end. These long lines can be over 40 miles in length total.
Mm-hmm.
Ours were not that long, but they can be that long. if you're a commercial fisherman, with thousands of gangians attached manually as the line goes out. So each hook is also baited with mackerel or some other kind of bait fish, but mackerel is kind of favored. Mm-hmm. And then the long line soaks for a determined number of hours before it is hauled back in. And that's dependent on what you're fishing for, time of year, if they're more active at night or during the day, that kind of thing. And so in the movie, they were literally baiting the long lines, like as they were hooking the Gangians on to the long line.
Oh, wow. Like simultaneously? Like, how do you do that? Like with one person doing that?
So they had one person putting the Gangian on and the other person baiting.
Oh, like at the same time.
Yeah, but that's so risky.
Yeah, I would get stabbed.
Right, and that's what happens. Like, a guy gets a hook through his hand and gets drugged off the boat.
In the movie?
In the movie.
Oh!
Like, so I read the book for this as well.
Which is why it ended up being
so long, because I'm like, oh, there's so much more details. And that, like, can happen. Oh. They said, like, yeah, that happens from time to time.
Oh, yeah, that happens from time to time.
And I'm like, we baited all of our Gangians before.
And then clipped them on. Yeah, that's what we did too. Like, it was like a couple seconds before, but it was like, you know, you baited them and you pass them off and then somebody else clipped them on. Yeah.
Yeah, we like would we'd bait a bunch of them, like 20, 30 or so, before we even had the flyer go out. And so we'd stick them on a barrel so that people would just literally grab them and put them on. But we'd be like 30 ahead of what we needed to.
Yeah, because... and that's what you call risk management, my friends.
I was watching the movie and I'm like, that's so fucking dangerous. That can't be real.
Yeah.
And I was reading the book and I was like, oh, it's real.
Oh, okay. It's real. Oh, God.
So, marine biology, everybody. I know. Yeah. And fishing. Fishing is like still the most dangerous job you can do in the States. Like,
oh,
more
yeah.
dangerous.
People get thrown overboard all the time and then they lose them. Oh, my God.
It's more dangerous than being a firefighter, a policeman, or a construction worker.
Mm-hmm.
Which is crazy to me, but it is.
Well, water is a strong element, man.
Mm-hmm. It'll get you.
It'll get you.
So by noon on October 25th, the Andrea Gale has a full load of swordfish in the hold, about 40,000 pounds of fish. And they are all the way east on the Flemish Cap, basically the farthest east they can fish and the farthest east they can be from Cape Cod. So Billy Tyne decides to start for home, knowing they will likely be the first boat to return because they were the first ones out. And they can charge a high price for the fish before the other boats come in because of the whole supply and demand thing.
Yeah.
He's eager to get back as the ice machine has malfunctioned and the only ice they have is the ice that's in the hold preserving the fish. So they can only preserve that for so long. So they have to go back, basically, or they will lose their whole month's worth of fishing.
Yeah, which not
is good. A lot of money.
That's like thousands of dollars, hundreds of thousands of dollars probably.
Yeah. And they have a several hundred mile trip back to Cape Cod at this point.
Hmm.
So Billy decided to head towards Sable Island, which is that small Canadian island, which is a narrow crescent shaped sandbar about 300 miles south of Halifax.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, it's just out there. It's like if you took the Outer Banks and put them out in the middle of the ocean instead of like on the shore.
Oh my God. Yeah. That'd be a nightmare.
Yeah. So the Andrea Gale reaches this area around October 27th. Just as they received those weather faxes. But they were in a hurry to get back to port and offload the fish so they don't spoil the month's work of fishing. So they decide to head into the storm. The other boats don't have this problem because one, their ice machines are working, and two, they are not as far east as the Andrea Gale. But they decide to stay east to avoid the storm and like continue fishing and working.
Mm-hmm.
Their last radio contact, the Andrea Gale's last radio contact with the other vessels in the fleet happens on October 28th, and they soon disappear, never to be heard from again. This story dominates both the book and the movie, The Perfect Storm. And while it is an interesting story, there's actually a better survival story to be told within The Perfect Storm that shows the incredible ability of humans to survive the worst conditions. And it is it's briefly touched on in the movie, and it is not accurate for a variety of reasons.
Yeah.
Part of it is like, okay, I get it. It's a movie. We need to streamline it. However, they get names wrong of some of the people involved.
Oh, that's frustrating.
It is frustrating. So much of the book and the movie is speculative on what happened to the Andrea Gale, which it's all fine and good to like talk about and pretend, but like we don't have any real solid information on how the ship like went down.
Gotcha.
Because it disappeared.
Yeah. It just goes away.
Yeah. So
probably
all those
just
guys
got swallowed, honestly.
Yeah. And I'll talk about some of the theories at the end, but like on the whole, it's not that I don't find it an interesting story and it makes for a very compelling movie, but we don't actually know what happened. So it is all speculative. Huh. You know what I mean? So let's talk about the actual true story that we have all the information about. And that is the Air Guard rescue. Okay. So meanwhile, while the Andrea Gale has disappeared, other vessels are finding themselves trapped in worsening weather in the North Atlantic, including some small sailboats and several large container ships and tankers. On October 30th, at about 3 in the afternoon, the Air National Guard, or Air Guard, stationed on Long Island, were called to rescue a Japanese sailboat sailed by a man named Tomizawa, 250 miles off the coast of New Jersey, that was starting to flounder and sink. And this was just like he owned the sailboat kind of thing.
Yeah.
It was just like a big ocean sailing sailboat.
Gotcha.
Because the sailboat was so far out, only the Coast Guard H-60, a helicopter that can refuel mid-flight, does not have to land to refuel.
And which it does talk about with Amelia Earhart, right? Because she was trying to refuel. See, I remember that.
Yeah. So they do this by connecting to a C-130 tanker plane. And this was the only helicopter that could reach the sailboat because it's so far offshore. So this mission is considered an increased risk mission, meaning weather conditions were extreme and the survivor was at great risk of dying. Rescuers in both the Coast Guard, Air Guard, any kinds of these kinds of rescuers call this sporty, meaning this is the kind of rescue is what it's all about for these rescuers. These only happen, you know, 5 to 10 times in a career. These are like the blockbuster kind of rescues, meaning it's fucking dangerous. That's what it means.
Fucking dangerous. Don't do it.
So I have a picture of the helicopter and the plane together, and that'll make more sense when I talk about how the helicopter hooked up. But the fuel lines are those long lines with the like white circle at the end of them.
Yes.
And the helicopter basically has to target for those. And they're just like blowing on the back of the plane.
Gotcha.
They're not like super stable.
Yeah.
So the Air Guard Pararescue Jumper is equivalent to Coast Guard rescue swimmers, and they are known as PJs. They are responsible for rescuing any civilians too far offshore for Coast Guard to reach, usually over 200 miles offshore. But during wartime, they're generally used to extract soldiers from behind enemy lines. So they have this dual purpose. All armed forces have a version of the PJ, but the Air Guard is the only ones with an ongoing peacetime mission that is coming to the aid of any ship off of North America, even if they aren't American. They also oversee space shuttle launches and landings. They're the guys that go up and pick up the capsule when it lands in the ocean, basically.
Yeah. Cool.
And like make sure the astronauts get out okay.
Yeah. Kind of that's cool. Yeah.
Training involves 18 months of full-time training, and they owe the government 4 years of service after. There are about 350 PJs around the country, so they are in demand and are often encouraged to extend their service beyond 4 years. And this is National Guard. This isn't like, you know, a fully active soldier. Like,
yeah,
they're doing this in their spare time kind of thing. You know what I mean?
Yeah, they're like, oh, just for funsies.
Like, they have another full-time job outside of this.
Yeah. Kind of thing, you know what I mean? Like how some pro athletes have another job outside of being a pro athlete.
Yeah, yeah. So the dropout rate for this training is over 90%, by the way.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Is it because it's too hard or too physically demanding?
Yes, let's talk about it. For example, in one drill, the team swims their 4,000-yard, their normal 4,000-yard workout. And then the instructor throws a whistle in the pool. And 10 guys fight for it. And the one guy that comes up gets to, like, with the whistle, gets to come out of the water. This is repeated until there's only one guy in the pool. And then that guy is kicked out of the school.
Oh, my God.
For example.
So, until there's only one guy left. And then the guy that's left that doesn't have the whistle gets kicked out of the school.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
No, thank you.
Yeah. So, after pre-training, which is like intense hazing, but underwater. Yeah. They go through scuba school, jump school, and survival school. And one of the training drills during this period is they are strapped in a simulated helicopter, plunged into the water. And if they escape, they are put back in upside down and do the same thing, and then upside down and blindfolded. And if they can, oh my
God,
if they can escape that, they get to be PJs, and the rest of them are kicked out and rescued by divers.
Oh my God, are they trying to kill them?
Yeah.
Oh my God,
you're literally put in a, like, you, I mean, they don't die because they get rescued by divers, but they're brought very close to death.
I would definitely die.
And I'm sure accidental deaths happen.
Yeah. They have to. I mean, given all of that, like, they have to happen.
Yeah.
I saw on the news a couple months ago, there was, like, a Navy SEAL in training that died. And it's like, golly.
Because you can't control for everything in a situation like that when you're underwater.
Yeah.
Like, and you don't have access to, like, a breathing apparatus. Even when you do, there's things that happen, you know?
Yeah.
So it's really, really intense training, you know? And so that's how you know these guys are, like, some of the best trained people.
That's insane.
To be doing this kind of stuff. So the team started its mission by planning out the rescue and determining if they can even do the rescue in the weather. And these are the best trained people in the country. And they're like, this weather's fucking bad.
Yeah.
So Major Dave Ruvola, the helicopter pilot, sat with his co-pilot, Captain Graham Busher, and Flight Engineer Staff Sergeant Jim Mioli, and the C-130, like, tanker plane pilots to plan out, like, their refueling points, basically. Mm-hmm. They were planning on doing a four in-air refuelings, one right off the coast, one before the rescue attempt, and two on the way back. So they have to do four refuelings in
That's
air.
That's insane.
Yeah.
That seems like so, like, much to balance.
Mm-hmm. You have to be good.
Mm-hmm.
You have to be very good.
Yeah, I can never.
Yeah. Meanwhile, the two rescue swimmers, Technical Sergeant John Spillane and Technical Sergeant Rich Smith, go to pick up their survival gear, including Mustang emergency suits or Gumby suits.
Oh.
Wetsuits, inflatable life vests, and mesh combat vests that contain a radio, flare kit, knife, strobe, matchbox, and compass. Have you ever had to wear a Gumby suit?
I haven't, but I thought Gumby suits were like the camouflage netting suits.
Mm-mm.
Why? What is that called?
I don't know. But Gumby suits are basically like, they're like, so they're, have you ever put on a survival suit?
Uh-uh.
They have them in most, like, open ocean going boats. And we had some on the Tidewater, too, but we never, like, practiced putting them on. But I did when I was doing sea semester because we were going to be in the North Pacific.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, they're basically, like, big.
They're a big suit. Dry suit.
Yeah, that you can put on over your clothes. And
gotcha.
And they're meant for cold, like, water survival, so you don't get hypothermia, basically.
Gotcha.
And they're a pain in the ass to put on.
I mean, I think a wetsuit's a pain in the ass to put on. I can't imagine putting one of those things on.
Well, and it's not because it's tight. It's because, like, once you put the gloves on your hands, like, it's really hard to, like, zip stuff up.
Yeah.
So we drilled getting them on in, like, a minute when we were on semester. Because that might be, like, the length of time you have to even put them on.
Gotcha.
We, like, drilled that.
Yeah.
Yeah. So...
So I also found out why I thought the Gumby suit was the camouflage one, because the camouflage suit is called a ghillie suit.
There you go. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's Gumby and ghillie. That's Gumby why I'm ghillie. Like, why can't I remember these things? They sound so similar to me.
Yes. Yeah. And I don't know if maybe we just called them Gumby suits, but I've heard them called Gumby suits several times.
No, I mean, so. I Googled Gumby suit and all that stuff came up. So they're definitely called that.
On the NOAA trip, they made us do that in like the middle of the day in September.
It was like hot out.
It was awful. I was like, really? Couldn't have done it like at least when the sun started going down.
Yeah, like when it was actually cold.
Ugh. So this is the situation that we are going into mm-hmm. in one of the worst storms, you know, in this area. So once the H-60 launches, they refuel off the coast. This involves hooking up to the coupling mechanism, triggering it, and fueling up using the drogue or fuel feeder tube, which was coming off of the plane. So when I say they hooked up to the drogue, it's that thing.
Gotcha.
So they have to fly behind the tanker plane at a decent rate of speed to do this. So this is fast rates of speed, and they've got to get their little... like hooky uppy thingy into the feeder tube.
My god, it seems so hard.
Super technical. So they were able to get 700 pounds of fuel with on their first go, as the weather isn't too bad yet. Mm-hmm. Within an hour of the flight, Rivola comes in for the second refueling and couples with the drogue after 4 attempts. So, like, as the weather gets worse, they have to... It gets harder, right?
Yeah.
So within 10 minutes, they're on the scene in this almost complete darkness. Spillane is ready to go, and he's one of the rescue divers. He's sitting in the spotter's window, and they see, with the spotlight, massive foam-laced swells rising and falling, some barely missing the belly of the helicopter as it hovers above the sailboat. The original plan is to lower the basket and the rescuers to the surface of the water, as the boat is moving with the waves way too fast for the swimmers to catch.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, the waves are so high that flight engineer Jim Mioli cannot keep up with the rise and fall of the waves with the basket, like lowering it down so it's in the water and raising it up with the waves.
Wow.
And this is a problem because if somebody gets tangled in the line attached to the basket when they're in the water, when the wave hits a trough,
yeah,
the basket rises out of the water, the force of that line could cut somebody in half.
Oh my god.
Or cut an arm or a leg off.
Oh my god.
Right. So they're also concerned about the wave action. It's likely if the swimmers were deployed, they may die, as so much water gets loaded in the air that rescue swimmers can drown just trying to breathe in these conditions.
Oh my god.
Yeah. So after 20 minutes of deliberation, it seems that any rescue attempt will actually put the Japanese sailor in more danger than he's already in. So it's better for him to stay with the boat. But Tamazawa is desperate, trying to get them to let him rescue himself, you know, by lowering the basket down to him. But that would risk the basket tangling up with the masts of the sailboat, and then they all end up in the water.
Yeah.
Which is what I believe that's what they do in the movie, or just, there's something like that that happens in the movie, but not accurate.
Gotcha.
The tanker plane drops two rescue rafts nearby in case the boat sinks, and then turn back towards the shore. Tamazawa was actually picked up later by a Romanian freighter. So he is eventually rescued. But like, this rescue is so difficult that not even the best guys in the world can do it.
Oh my goodness. Yeah, that's so That's a strong storm.
Yeah. So the H-60 picks up another like 1,500 pounds of fuel on its third hiccup after three attempts, and they will need one more refueling to make it back to shore. Tanker pilots are responsible for relaying real-time weather conditions to the helicopters that are faxed to them from like the bases on shore.
Mm-hmm.
However, in this case, the base never relays extra information because the tanker never asked for it. This extra information would include a massive band of rain developing off Long Island between 7:30 and 8 p.m., just when they are starting back to land. This severe weather could be avoided by having the H-60 fly 15 miles to the west, but they do not know what they are flying into. They have no idea that this thing is here.
Yeah.
So Rivola thinks he's left the worst of the weather behind, but this rain band is roughly 80 miles long and 10,000 feet thick with winds of 75 knots and a visibility of zero, basically.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not great. And the big issue is the refueling, right?
Yeah, because they have to see where they're catching that thingamajig to hook it in and fill up their fuel.
So almost as soon as they call for a refilling at 7:55, they hit the band because they don't know it's there.
Yeah.
If they knew it was there, they'd probably have refueled before they get to it.
Yeah. Oh, my goodness.
So Rivola can barely control the aircraft, and flying has become as much of a question of physical strength as finesse. The helicopter tries to hit the drogue, but the aircraft and the drogue are moving around so wildly that it's like throwing darts down a gun barrel. Hitting the target is pure dumb luck, according to Rivola. So he can barely see the wing lights of the tanker, even with night vision goggles. That's how bad the visibility is.
Golly, that sucks.
They make 20 to 30 attempts to hit the drogue. But the tanker pilot says he has to shut down engine one as the oil pressure gauge is fluctuating wildly. When they re-extend the hose after shutting down the engine, the hose, which is usually full of air that keeps it somewhat steady, is just kind of flapping in the wind at this point.
Yeah.
So they have to switch over to the right-hand drogue, which means they have to come in tighter to the plane to make contact. So this is more dangerous.
Oh, yeah.
They make a few more runs on the right-hand drogue, but they ultimately lose contact with the C-130 in the clouds.
Oh, my God.
So now they are on their own.
Oh, no.
So at this point, they are 4,000 feet above the sea in zero vis with roughly 20 minutes of fuel left.
Oh, no.
They can... And they're still, like, hundreds of miles offshore. Like, they're not...
Yeah. They're not a quick flight back. Yeah.
They can either try to find the plane and try to connect to the drogue, or they can make a controlled descent while they still have fuel.
Hmm.
So Rivola decides to set up for a planned ditching, which is a fancy way to say a controlled crash.
Yep, that's what I would assume.
So John Splane says of the experience, throughout my career, I've always managed just barely to keep things in control. But now, suddenly, the risk is becoming totally uncontrollable. We can't get fuel. We're going to end up in that roaring ocean, and we're not going to be in control anymore. And I know the chances of being rescued are practically zero. I've been on a lot of rescue missions, and I know they can hardly even find someone in these conditions, let alone recover them. We're some of the best in the business, best equipped, best trained. We couldn't do a rescue a little while earlier, and now we're in the same situation. It looks real bleak. It's not going to happen. So this is like worst case scenario. Mm-hmm. And even if you're trained for this, and especially because you're trained for this, you're like, this isn't going to end well.
No.
Like, yeah. So they send out a mayday on Air National Guard frequencies and hail the Tamaroa, which is a Coast Guard cutter ship 15 miles northeast of them, letting them know the situation before they crash the helicopter.
Mm-hmm.
They're basically on their own, and they're going down. While it's a plan ditching, things will quickly spiral out of control. And soon, even if it all goes well, you know, if they survive the planned crash, they will be mm-hmm. floating in impossibly high seas in one of the worst nor'easters ever seen.
God, and that just is not a good time.
And that little cliffhanger is where I'm going to be leaving us until
next episode. Okay. I gotcha.
So that's the beginning of The Perfect Storm, part one.
Yeah. Yay.
Yeah. And so this story takes up like one chapter of the book.
Yeah.
But it is so like fascinating. And I'm like, this should be its own fucking book. Like, no offense to Andrea Gale, but like,
yeah,
because it's horrible that they all died, but so much of the book is spent on speculating what happened.
Yeah. And it's like, you just want to hear more about the story than the speculation.
Yeah. And it is interesting. They talk a lot about the swordfish fishery and just like fisheries in Cape Cod in general. So that was, yeah, you know, interesting and relevant to me. But yeah, so there's just chapters of like, well, this is Billy Tyne might have said this, and then they might have done this. And it's like, yeah, well, we don't know. We don't know. Right. So,
yeah.
So that's, I don't know, all those like crazy Coast Guard and like military rescues that they have to do, like in storms, that shit fascinates the hell out of me. Like,
yeah, I mean, it's so dangerous. And like, just what you were saying about how like there's no visibility and the waves are coming up from the bottom and it's like hitting the basket. I had no idea the line was that strong and I guess sharp to cut somebody.
Well, I believe it's like, you know, that like it's wire, metal wire kind of.
Yeah.
So, and it's, you just assume like, oh yeah, they'll just come down and get you. And it's like, well, like, but if
no, they can't really just come down and get you that easily. Yeah.
And there's like other rescues that have this similar issue because the wave action is so intense that they, they're like, it's probably safer for you to stay on your floundering ship than try to get out in the water.
Right.
And swim for your life. Like, yeah.
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 I know. It's like the whole save many and lose one, or like try to save one and lose all kind of situation.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
So my citations for this was the book, The Perfect Storm by Sebastian Junger, which is probably like the movie was, you know, aspects of it were really good, aspects of it not so much. So if you want like the factual version of this, just read the book, I guess. But the movie is on Hulu, so if you're interested, go watch it.
Thank you.
And then How Do Hurricanes Form from NOAA. The 1991 Perfect Storm from Wikipedia, just so I could get the timing right. Because the storm description in the book was very confusing. I'm like, okay, what is happening when? I need to figure this out.
Yeah.
Because there's a lot of things that happen. It, you know, like the hurricane combines with a nor'easter, and then it turns into a hurricane again. Like,
yeah, so you're like, when did it actually start happening?
Yeah, yeah. So I was trying to figure that out. And then 30 October 1991 by Brian Swopes, This Day in Aviation History. So those are my sources for this.
Good deal.
And we'll continue it next episode. And then after that, we're getting into spooky season.
Spooky season!
We're going to do some spooky stuff.
Yeah, that's exciting.
I would say maybe we should save our conservation corner for next time.
Yeah, for sure. I was gonna ask you if we could, because honestly, when I saw it was The Perfect Storm and about swordfish, I was gonna pick the swordfish for the. But you already kind of talked about them, so no, you're good. I was like, we already kind of talked about it, and
I mean,
like,
you can add on to it because it was very brief.
You know? No, it's all good. We can just, you know, do the next episode.
You can always talk about cod.
Cod. We'll do cod next episode. How about that?
Because that's the biggest fishery. There's a whole book about it that I've read, of course, that's about the cod fishery, like the rise and fall of the cod fishery. And it is so fascinating. Like, literal wars were fought over this fish. Like,
because, oh my god.
Yeah, it was so plentiful. The reason why people in Massachusetts, like the old money folks in Massachusetts, are so rich is because their ancestors, like,
or the cod got industry.
in the cod fishery.
That's fair.
There's a plaque with a cod on it, I think, in their like state building in Boston.
Oh, really?
That's how important the fish is to the state.
That's crazy.
It was a huge fishery for a long time.
Yeah, I'm sure. So, that's crazy, though.
Yeah. Anyway.
Oh, cool. Yeah. Anyway, we'll just save Conservation Corner for next episode when we finish up the whole story and have more fish to talk about.
Yeah, and donate to the victims of the Lahaina wildfires if you can.
Yes. Yeah, for sure. Definitely.
They need it. Ooh, happy things, I guess.
Happy things. I recently got back from Wyoming with my dad. We went on that trip that I won, so that was awesome. We went horseback riding, fly fishing, just hiking and walking around the parks, and I got him into the Junior Ranger program, so he got his little Junior Ranger badges from Grand Teton and Yellowstone, so that was cool. Yeah. No, that was a good trip. That was really fun. But I am still kind of like exhausted from it, and then I leave
Connecticut.
I leave next week for Connecticut because I'm in my friend's wedding up there.
Mm-hmm.
And then after her wedding, Alex's cousin gets married in Iowa, so we're gonna go to Iowa. And that is after that wedding. That is the end of my fucking travels this year, besides Thanksgiving. But that is like a month and a half away from but I'm like, dear God, literally. Every month since April, sometimes twice a month, I have been traveling somewhere. Yeah.
So if you look at our schedule real quick, that means we're going to have to record next weekend too, so that we have it recorded before you go.
That's fine. Yeah, we can do that again.
Because you're like out for 2 weeks.
I know. I'm going to be working remotely, and like, I knew these couple of weeks were going to suck, like, work-wise. And, like, I'm still working. I'm just doing it remotely. But it's just one of those things where, like, man, I haven't been in the office in quite some time. But, yeah, that was my happy thing, was Wyoming and Connecticut for weddings. And
did you see any, like, wildlife?
We did. Yes, we did. So, every day, pretty much, we saw wildlife. So, we got in on Friday afternoon. We were driving out of the park Friday evening, and we saw a moose mama and her little baby.
Whoa.
On Little Creek, just kind of romping around, drinking the water, hanging out.
Aww.
So that was really cool. And then the next morning, we were driving into the park, and we saw like three elk. We drove right by one because it was like right on the side of the road.
Mm-hmm.
And then we saw two other in a field. And then Sunday, we didn't see one. I don't think we saw one on Sunday. Because I was like, we were fishing on Sunday, and I was like, mm-hmm. Oh, I wonder if we're going to see like any animals by the river. Cause like, it's going to be morning, you know? But we didn't see any animals by the river, but, we caught some fishes. So obviously that was nice. And then we left on Monday. So
yeah,
it was good. It was, apparently my dad's never seen a moose before, so that was cool for him to see two moose. And then seeing the elk, I don't know if he's ever seen elk before either. And we were like, we drove right past one because it was like literally right on the side of the road, like grazing.
Yeah.
So there was like no way to go around it. You just have to go slow past it. So
yeah. The first moose I actually ever saw was in Grand Teton National Park.
Oh, cool. Yeah.
So, and I think my first elk was in Colorado.
Yeah. Mine was, I think, in Utah or Colorado, something like that. Yeah.
American West. It's just so cool. So full.
I know. And the horseback riding that we did was awesome.
Yeah.
Like, it wasn't just like around somebody's ranch. It was like we went across the road down into this meadow, and then we like climbed up a mountain essentially into like an aspen forest, and then through like these high mountain forests, and then rounded the top into like a high mountain meadow kind of thing. And then there was like overlooking like the Teton Range. And then we just like made our way back down to the ranch, and it was That's really cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, like, dad looked at the elevation at the ranch, and it was like 6,000 feet. And then he looked at the elevation when we were on top of the mountain, it was like 8,000 feet. So, like, pretty much climbed like 2,000 feet of elevation with horses.
It's a big hike. Yeah.
Yeah. So it was cool, though.
I highly recommend, if you have the time and the money, doing like a horseback riding excursion, because it helps when you're tired of hiking.
Yes.
And two, like, you get all these cool views, you get to interact with an animal. Like, we did one, our last one that we did like recently was in Terlingua, in Big Bend. So that
Nice.
was really, and you get like a lot of cool views that maybe you have to
Yeah.
put in a lot more effort to get. Like,
Yeah. That's what I was telling my dad. I was like, holy shit, we climbed 2,000 feet in elevation in like 4 hours. That would have taken us all day to do that.
exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was cool. That was a cool experience. And then we fly fished the Snake River. So that's like, the iconic Snake River over there. That was really cool. We caught a lot of Yellowstone cutthroat trouts, which is, I don't know, cutthroats are a little near and dear to my heart because I worked with them out in Utah, except those were the Colorado River cutthroat trouts.
Yes, there's a lot of subspecies in
Yeah.
the West, I've noticed.
Yes. So, but that was fun to catch them, and they weren't too big. They were like fun sized, like yearling type of size. But it was still fun to catch them. Like, it was so funny. Like, I put my like fly in the water. The line was just drifting in a current, and I was like, oh, I'm just gonna take a break for a second, and, like, get a drink of water. I'm like drinking my water. I'm like, I have a hand on the rod too, but like, and then I feel it pull, and I'm like, holy shit, did I just catch a fish? Like, and like, that's kind of like how easy it was for me. But then my poor dad in the back, he's like trying to cast and see the fly, and you can't see it. And like, he's like, how the hell are you doing
That's so funny.
He caught some though, so that was good. But the fly we were using, it was so small. It was like a little, I think it was like a midge or something like that. But it was white. And they're in the ruffles of the water, you have like the white bubbles and stuff too. So it was really hard for him, and even myself, like, it was hard for me to see it too, to see where the fly was, to track it. So that was a little challenging, but it was fun. It was a good time. But anyway, what's your happy thing?
I guess I don't have any trips for a while. I went on my last work trip this past week up to Houston, Clear Lake, actually, right by the Space Center. Because we're kind of like wrapping up our eel project. And so this isn't normal of collaborative work, I would say,
Yeah.
but one of our PIs wanted to have like a little party to kind of
Oh,
celebrate all the
that's
work.
fun.
So we went up there, we did a bunch of morphological kind of measurements on the eels that we did catch in the lab. So we did that during the day, and then we had like a little party at night. It was just kind of like a nice closure to that project. And in no way are we done,
Yeah.
but the data analysis and writing is kind of out of my hands right now because we have a grad student attached to the project. So
Gotcha.
they have to do their shit first before we can think about trying to publish,
And
basically.
hopefully they get their shit done.
Yeah, well, that's another story for another
Yeah, I know. You're not the first person that I've heard have a hard time with grad students, so.
So that was nice, and I'm still like presenting on this topic at a bunch of conferences coming up, but like that I can kind of put that aside and like focus on the alligator gar stuff, which is
Oh, cool.
also slowed down because it's so hot that we aren't catching a whole lot of
Oh, I'm
gar. They've all
sure.
moved off probably up river. Where the salinity is less,
Yeah.
not as high, but we'll see what happens this fall when we
Okay.
go back out for gill nets. So we'll see. That's my happy thing.
Cool. Nice. Sounds like a good one.
Yeah.
If you ever need a volunteer, you can just hit me up. I'll fly myself out there.
With what time, Haley?
I
What
don't know.
time do you
I
have?
don't know. I'll make the time.
All right. So where can our listeners find us?
Our listeners can find us on any streaming platform. So you got your Google Podcasts, Spotify Podcast, and Apple Podcasts. If you want to find us on social media, we are on Instagram at Mother Nature Will Kill You Podcast. We are on TikTok at MNWKY Podcast. We're on Facebook as Mother Nature Will Kill You. And then we have a website, MotherNatureWillKillYouPodcast.com. You can go listen to us there, or give us any questions or stories in our contact tab.
And if you have a story that you want to share with us, if you are a rescue swimmer, we want to hear all about your fucking life. But if you just had kind of an uncomfy experience in nature, like maybe you were on a slowly sinking ship or boat one time, even if it was just in the middle of a lake or something like that, you can submit your story to. We have a page on the website that you can just submit to, or you can submit it to the Gmail. In addition, if you want to support the podcast but you have no money because we live in a post-capitalist hellscape, as exhibited by the response to the Maui fires, you can give us a 5-star review on any of our listening platforms. That is the best way to support us without paying any money. All right. So next week we will conclude this story, and then it'll be spooky season, baby. Woo-hoo-hoo. Hell yes. I'm ready. Well,
me too. And you know what? I've seen on Facebook, people are joking about Augtober. Like Augtober.
Yeah.
And I'm like, guys, it's still freaking summer. Like fall happens in September. Yeah. Right? Like that's the official date of fall.
Here's the thing though.
How are you starting so early?
If Christmas is going to butt up to freaking Halloween, then we're going to get in this. I don't care. I'll put my ghost stuff out.
I just was thinking about it. I was like, holy shit, is all of this stuff kind of like starting to encroach a little bit more? Yeah. I was like, we're in a climate crisis. It's still fucking hot out. Like,
yeah, we're in hell. So
doing this.
We're literally in hell. So why not celebrate spooky season? Right?
Yeah, it's like we need something to celebrate. We're already here. Bring out the demons.
Yes. smells like sulfur when I go outside. So just, you know. Make it happen.
Hang some ghosts up anyway. It's fine.
Exactly. All right. Well,
until next time, friends, stay safe, but most of all,
stay curious, explorers.
Bye.
Yeah, bye.